here. So I'm going to pick up where Rick left and talk about the underlying event and some new ideas that we've been developing over the past year in Lund. And so as you probably understood from Rick's talk, the average hadron-hadron collision looks something like this. So since we're in California, this is actually a Frisbee-Frisbee collision, but it's a complicated business with lots of things going on. And so Torbjörn is fond of saying that if a model is simple, it's wrong. So what I'm going to present is a more complicated model that hopefully will allow us to gain a deeper physics insight into what's actually going on in the average hadron-hadron collision. So as you saw, Toon A is working pretty well of the old multiple interactions model. The problem from our point of view is that we really don't know the physics reasons why it works, and we're going to try to study that and improve our understanding.
Ultimate Frisbee must be a rougher game than I thought.
It was tough. So I'll just give a lightning review of the basic phenomenology of multiple interactions. Rick has already said a lot of things. And then I'll turn over to the new ideas that we have that are implemented in Pythia 6.3. So I'll start with the easiest things and come down to the things that are still causing us to scratch our heads and where we will need some more help of experimental input as well. So the underlying event, basically we'd like to understand the correlations and fluctuations that occur in hadronic collisions. And for that, simple parameterizations that we have that can be tuned to describe maybe the average underlying activity are insufficient. So from the point of view of just QCD, there are a lot of interesting questions here that remain unanswered and that we'd like to try to answer. Obviously, also from other points of view, these fluctuations, random as well as systematic, in the activity that underlies a hard scattering can impact things like isolation cuts or like your jet profiles, your jet energy scales, and so forth. So also from other points of view, it would be nice if we had a more reliable understanding of the underlying event. And obviously, lots of fresh data is coming in. The Tevatron is well underway. The LHC is drawing closer. So it's really a great topic for phenomenology right now. So just to start the thing off, if you just consider perturbative QCD 2-2 scattering, you have something like this. You have these 2-2 processes, which are dominated by T-channel gluon exchange in the high energy limit. So it goes something like 1 over pt to the fourth, so 1 over t squared. And if you just integrate that cross-section, well, it's divergent, right? So if you introduce some infrared cutoff, pt min, you just ask what's the cross-section for having a pair of jets that are harder than some pt min. Then you find that goes roughly like 1 over pt min squared. So if you plot that, here is for the LHC, the total cross-section, hadron-hadron cross-section is about 100 millibarns. You don't need to make the distinction here whether it's inelastic, non-diffractive, and so forth. It's about 100 millibarns. And if you see, if you just plot this 1 over pt min squared rise, then the 2-2 scattering cross-section becomes larger than the total cross-section at a pt min value of about 5 GeV. Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the certainly the rise is much stronger than
Yeah, yeah, okay, but this is just a rough qualitative argument. So there are other effects as well.
Yeah, that's why.
So this is, I think, with the, what, CTEC 5 parton distributions and so forth. It's fairly realistic. Anyway, you find that this 2-2 cross-section becomes larger than the total cross-section at a pt min value of about 5 GeV. And obviously, that's still, you know, perturbatively large. At some point, obviously, you'd expect this picture to be complete nonsense, this 1 over pt squared rise, modulo parton distributions, because if you've got a gluon with a wavelength like this and a proton with a size like this, obviously, the gluon wouldn't be able to resolve the color charge inside. But 5 GeV is a pretty large number. So let's see if we can understand that. And the way we interpret that is, there are two reasons. One of them is just this multiple interactions mechanism. Obviously, hadrons are bunches of incoming partons, as Rick has been talking about. And so just intuitively, multiple interactions must exist at some level. It should be possible for several parton pairs to collide with each other in a single hadron-hadron collision. So if you think about it, what does the total cross-section count? It counts the number of hadron-hadron collisions that you've got. So you can write it as a sum of having, say, one jet pair, two jet pairs, three jet pairs, and so forth in a collision. What does the two-to-two scattering cross-section count? Well, it actually counts the number of interactions in this beam of partons that you have. So if you think about it, the two-to-two cross-section, well, if you have two scatterings, independent scatterings in one hadron-hadron collision, then that'll count twice in the two-to-two cross-section. So one way of looking at it is just that the fact that the two-to-two cross-section is larger than the total cross-section is just a statement that you have, on average, more than one interaction per hadron-hadron collision. Second reason is, of course, as I mentioned, that at some point you'll start, perturbative QCD will start to break down, and you'll start to get destructive color interference, if you will, or that the gluons will not be able to resolve the net color charges, and the coupling will be damped. Empirically, you need numbers of around 2 GeV here. That's, for instance, what Rick uses in his 2A for the Tevatron. So one thing you can do if you want to verify your ideas that multiple interactions exist is you can go out and look directly to see it. The basic idea here is that if you've got two parton-parton scatterings, so like Rick was saying, the background to double parton scattering is basically that you have one interaction that radiates twice. But in double parton scattering, you would expect to have two more or less uncorrelated jets which pairwise balance in PT. So what the actual field spectrometer went out and looked for was four jet events. They went down to pretty low ETs. Otherwise, you don't see it so well because of this 1 over PT squared rise. So what they did was they projected out two pairs of jets, and they looked at this variable here, where this PT1 squared is the sum PT of one of the jet pairs, and PT2 squared is the sum PT of the other jet pair. And they saw an excess of events where this combination, where this one was small and this one was small, so where the two jet pairs each were both more or less balancing. What CDF has done is they've been comparing double parton scattering to just two different events where you have two independent scatterings. And what they find, so this Pythia here is actually Pythia with multiple interactions turned off. And then they add these double parton events. So what this is relying on is that they should be more or less uncorrelated in phi, whereas if you have Bremsstrahlung, they should still be pretty much back to back. So you see this Bremsstrahlung here is peaking, whereas the double parton scattering component is more or less flat. And they found that they needed something like 53% double parton scattering to explain their data.
Can you remind me, did we do any tunes or try, you know, Pythia, just to see if it could model the double parton scattering?
I can't remember exactly what you did.
I don't think you did either for that. Yeah.
As I said, I was very upset that you quoted Pythia, but the only test you ever did of Pythia was with Pythia with multiple interactions switched off. And for the rest, you never mentioned Pythia results.
Right. I mean, the person who did this analysis, unfortunately, is out of high energy physics now, but the data, you know, is still there in some form. But we can do this in round two. And this is leading. Well, look at, you know.
It's a pretty simple thing to do, right? So.
We can just do this with jets.
The idea that makes this useful is the photons, because it really just defines a clean event that it's easy to see. Double parton scattering in.
But do you have this in run two as well? I mean, I guess you must have.
We have the photon analysis. We have the photon data.
Yeah.
We just have it at a higher trigger threshold, but still there's a lot of data. This is run 1A, right? So this is based on like 19 inverse peak events.
Yeah.
So it's certainly possible to do this kind of study again.
But you say you have a higher threshold, because that's a problem in general, that the higher PT jets you require, or PT photons, whatever you require, the more Bremsstrahlung gains in importance relative to double parton scattering.
So you need to go
pretty low. Because you have two scatterings, both suppressed by this 1 over PT to the fourth. So Bremsstrom always wins out if you go to very, very high T values.
You know, I think, you know, instead of 16, you know, it'll be like 23 or so GeV photons.
Depends on statistics and so on, that's what I'm right there. But it would be better if you could go somewhat lower. So, I mean, if they have 50-50 here, if you go to 23, maybe it's 60-70% that's Bremsstrahl, and 40%.
Well, we could try to run TrueNA and see if we'd expect to see a signal.
16 GeV photons.
First, before doing the analysis.
Yeah, nobody's
plus a jet on the other side. And then the two extra jets are 5-7 GeV.
So yeah, okay. Yeah, what kind of cut area. Where you would be blind.
I would guess you got to go way down, like 2, 3, 4.
So the same thing could be done no matter what.
Well, the lower the better. So, but we could try to run 2 and A and see. So, yeah?
I'm confused about something you first said. So if you turn off the multiple parton scattering, there's still an underlying event which is described by some non-coordinated parameters in here.
Yeah, then you basically just got a pair of strings stretched across the event that had
models. And so you could then take that model and tune it up to describe the data as well as possible.
It's very hard to tune the hadronization because, you see, that's tuned to LEP data. And very precisely so. So unless hadronization takes place in a radically different way at a hadron collider, as compared to any plus-minus collider, which is a hard.
You could do what you say. So you could make a model for that. I mean, that's sort of what Heerwig does. That's Heerwig has a model for the big beam remnants, which isn't off by too terrible amount. Okay, but those models are soft. They don't have jets in them.
Okay.
Whereas okay, yeah, you can play around with the beam remnants as well in the old model, but
even if they both agreed with the averages, they wouldn't agree with the clumpiness. So you still could figure it out.
Well, it's true. I mean, the problem I'm having is it's obviously true in the extremes. But could I make this what's roughly 50-50, 70-30, by tuning the non-perturbative parameters of the underlying event? I probably could.
Yeah, sure. But what you could not do is, so to speak, take a model where you switch off multiple interactions and get an activity of the underlying event that is as high as what Rick will show you. Because kind of what you're saying is you have one half scattering, say quark-quark scattering. Then you have two color triplet charges in the central region of the event.
Yeah.
And you will only then have triplet charges at outskirts of the events, which means that you will only be drawing two strings out to them. Mm-hmm. And then the amount of energy per unit rapidity in those strings is essentially fixed by so to speak, left fragmentation parameter. And that number is much lower than what Rick was showing. So somehow, either in our case, we have to say that you have pull out several color charges from the incoming beams, so that we have multiple strings running around over the event to get up the multiplicity. Or else you have to just take, like Herbert does, just take UA5 data and parametrize it without really saying where the physics is, just saying this is what you observe, let's plug that in.
But it is true that in the proton-proton collision, there are several color charges that are going forward.
And you don't really know how
somehow
those
charges
are flowing.
But then it is about the interaction, except that you're saying it's some kind of soft interaction.
Yeah.
It doesn't show up as jets,
that's right.
But you still have some kind of exchange of colors between the two objects.
So you can see that from,
right. Sure, you could do a model like that, but that's not what we're doing. We're saying that, so then you could have a model that in principle gives you the level of the underlying event, but then you still would not have the fluctuation in that line.
No.
Yeah, that's what I was
so
saying.
That's a bit like
you could distinguish. You will make the model, and then we could distinguish it by the clumpiness, because your model would be soft, whereas the multiple parton interactions have a hard component. They make a hard component inside the beam remnants.
Yeah.
And at some stage, someday with enough data, one could distinguish
so,
those two models.
So certainly an exercise like this one would be hard to explain with just a soft underlying event, right?
But I mean, remember that here, kind of, if you say that this is the tail of multiple interactions where you actually have two interactions that are very hot. If the typical CDF event in our model contains, say, three or four multiple interactions, the typical mean PT of such interactions is around 2-3 GeV or less. Some may be below 2 GeV. So they are kind of getting to this region where you're saying that it really corresponds to the change of color, not very much PT, but at least there is the tail, and it's kind of part of the same framework.
So you have two components, right? You have a sort of underlying event that are also some multi-pattern scattering. So we are really questioning that.
In our framework, it's the same, right?
So
the entire underlying event.
No, the underlying event may have two components, which is just the separation of color charge and fragmentation plus the multi-pattern scattering. So the question is, what is the relative importance? And you can make different models.
In our framework, it's the same.
We have one model.
The
point is that we make no distinction between the first interaction and the second interaction. I mean, they are both perturbative interactions, and the third interaction, so on and so forth. In Herwig, you make a distinction that underlying event is something completely different from the hard scattering. But in our case, we make the statement that each interaction is given by perturbation theory.
So I think you'll understand a little bit better if I just proceed what exactly is going on. Okay, so you can also go out and do indirect verifications. So hadronization alone, if you just got a string, let's say you have a certain length of string and you hadronize it, the number of particles that, or charged hadrons or whatever you want to count, that that string piece produces will be a Poissonian distribution, roughly, modulo energy and momentum conservation effects. Certainly, it's very hard to get a very broad multiplicity distribution, for instance, from just hadronization alone. But what additional soft interactions do, you have to remember, we go down to PTs of these interactions that are, 2 GeV. So they are very soft. So you can say, yes, there is a soft component in our model, but we base it on perturbation theory. So we just go down in scatterings to relatively soft PTs. And what they do is they don't produce multiple minijets, right? You can have harder interactions as well that do that. But what these soft interactions do is they mess up the color flow. And you can have strings being stretched across the event, or you can short-circuit the color flow, and you can do many things there. And the other thing is that we have this impact parameter-dependent picture of the proton. So that there is a clumpiness in the transverse structure of the proton when they collide, that you have regions of high density and regions of low density, which gives rise to that some interactions, head-on collisions, will have many interactions or be disposed to have many interactions in general. And peripheral collisions will have few interactions. And all of those things give you a broad multiplicity distribution, many fluctuations, and a tail out to very large multiplicities. And so if you restrict yourself to having at most one hard interaction in the Pythia framework, you'll have a much too narrow charged multiplicity distribution, for instance. You can also go and look at other variables and convince yourself that at least from our perspective, it's very difficult to explain the underlying activity without having multiple interactions. And then
does the program then start off by throwing some dice and saying, OK, this one has an impact parameter of
So the first step in the model is to generate the PT of the hardest interaction together with an impact parameter. And then that impact parameter determines the overlap function for the rest of the scatterings as well, which then go down in PT successively. So we order them in PT. But let me get to describing the model, and then you'll probably understand better. So, okay, this is just to summarize multiple interactions that they're sort of guaranteed to exist, and you have lots of experimental verification of that they exist, and that they do lead to correlations and fluctuations, which are currently poorly understood, although we can parameterize them. We don't understand what the detailed mechanisms are. Even when they're soft, they can affect the color flow, which is very important at the hadronization stage. And when they're semi-hard, they'll give you multiple minijets in your event. And of course, they affect anything you want to do with jets. So a good understanding of this physics is probably a good thing to have if you want to do precision physics that involves jets or the underlying event. So this talk is not about the model that Rick was talking about. It's about the model that we've been developing over the last year, which is in Pythia 6.3. And so Clement of Alexandria, this guy there, wrote an exhortation to the heathen about 200 AD. And he was saying that this assembly had gathered to celebrate the slaying of the Pythic serpent, version 6.2. And then some guy sang an epitaph for the reptile, and well, whether that should be a hymn or a dirge is up to each individual person to determine. So when you look at a hadron-hadron collision, sort of a, well, let's take a Min bias or some underlying event, whatever hard scattering you want to look at, you've got a number of things going on. In the multiple interactions formalism, you have a number of partons that will interact with each other. And you have a number of, so that's these guys here in this example, and you have a number of partons that are left behind in the beam remnant. And there are going to be correlations between these partons. There are going to be correlations in flavor, in momentum, and you want to know how they're correlated in color. This is just one example. You want to know what the impact parameter dependence is. You want to know what the energy dependence of all these mechanisms is. So there are a lot of questions that you want to ask, and that we may have some idea of what the answers to some of them are, and some of them are still causing us to scratch our heads. So there's a long list of questions here that we would like to study and that we have studied. And also you could ask yourself whether showers could be intertwined, whether if you have a splitting in a shower, whether both of those partons could participate in interactions. You could say, well, if I have two scatterings, I'm evolving backwards. What's the probability that they both came from a single splitting at a lower Q-squared scale? Or should you evolve everything back to the shower cutoff scale and then connect them there? That's an unresolved question at present. But if you just consider a hadron, say a proton, how should you describe such an object? Well, ideally, you should describe it by some big correlated parton distribution function that gives you the probability of finding n flavors, each carrying n different momentum fractions of the proton when probed at n different Q squared scales. But obviously, I mean, Joey is going to shake his head if we try to ask the CTEC people to deliver such distributions to us, because we only have information on n equals 1, the single particle inclusive parton distributions that we all know and love. So how are we going to do this? Well, we'd like to employ a strategy where the hardest scattering is described by the standard parton distribution. So we sort of maximize the use of the knowledge that we already have. And then for each of the lower PT scatterings, we'll introduce successive modifications to those parton distributions to describe what we've already taken out of the proton, so to speak. Now, Yeah, sure. So you could say the single particle inclusive parton densities, what do they describe? Well, they describe the probability of taking a proton and partitioning it into a remnant object plus a certain flavor that has a certain, you know, X probed at some scale Q. And what we want to do is then to say, well, given this object, what parton distributions describe that, knowing that we've already taken out that? And then we would do that by modifying the parton distributions of those to try to take into account that we've taken this out, and so on and so forth.
I'm checking my output, yes.
Okay, so our help is that we can generate these interactions in an ordered sequence of falling PT, so that we generate the first one first, and we use the standard parton distributions to describe that. And then we evolve the shower backwards and would have more interactions going on, and then this interaction would of course be correlated to what's happening over there, and so forth and so on. So the question that we're asking is basically, what are the parton distributions describing a proton that has had a number of partons knocked out to it? What an arbitrary remnant object with an arbitrary number of flavors, partons kicked out of it. So the first thing you want to make sure that you're getting right is just momentum conservation. You can't kick more momentum out of the proton than there is in it. So the way that was done already in the old model, so that also goes for 2NA, is that you assume just a simple scaling ansatz in X. So if we say that this large capital X here just describes how much momentum is remaining in the proton, So if you start by having x equals 1, then the CTEC 6 U distribution looks something like this, the red curve. And if we then imagine that we've kicked out what corresponds to an x equals 0.3, then what we do is we simply scale the distribution in x so that it now ends at 0.7. But then, of course, you would violate the momentum sum rule. You would violate your counting rules for having exactly two valence quarks and so forth. So you need to scale it in y as well to make sure that all those sum rules are respected. So that's a rather primitive procedure, but it's worked okay for a while. Now we want to go further and introduce more physics. Obviously, if a valence quark is kicked out, and many of the parton distributions give you that information separately, then you'd have to modify your valence quark counting rule. You'd have to say that, well, there's only one U quark left, or there's no D quark, valence quarks left. If you kick out a C quark, then by flavor conservation, obviously, there has to be an anti-quark somewhere inside the remnant object, which integrates to 1 over the remaining x. So if the kicked out C quark had a fraction xs, then the remaining range is 0 to 1 minus xs. And then you should introduce some companion distribution that integrates to 1. Of course, if you start just subtracting some valence content and adding some distribution here, you're also going to violate the total momentum sum rule. So what's inside the proton will no longer sum to x. So what we do then is we suppose if you kick out a valence quark, then the C has gained in relative importance. So we scale up the C by a factor that exactly compensates. And if we introduce a companion antiquark, or a companion quark to a kicked out C antiquark, we scale down the C, because what you're doing if you introduce one of these things is actually you're just bookkeeping a part of the flavor and momentum content of the C separately. So you just scale down the rest of the C. And I could, if you're interested, I'll tell you afterwards exactly how these how we arrive at these distributions.
Plus, I would say your paper is linked to on the web.
Right, okay, so there are 69 pages there that you can read if you like. And this is also gone through in some detail. So these are the parton distributions that we use, which reduce to the ordinary ones for the first scattering, and then have these successive modifications built into them, describing our increasing, you know, collapse of the proton wave function. And these companion distributions, obviously it's the gluon splitting that's causing it, so the gluon splitting is symmetric, and you get, this is in momentum, some fairly symmetric distributions with, of course, squeezing here close to x equals 1, and this is just different options for the gluon distribution functions.
So that was a very good study for the Trajan numbers.
You mean these double parton distributions that they've been trying to do? Well, the problem is you can't experimentally constrain those, right? Because we don't have...
You make a much more explicit
assumption. This is, I mean, we need to use this to find out which flavors are kicked out, right? And we try to do the best we can with the information that Joey and friends are able to provide us. Yeah, yeah. So these, I mean, this is not a God-given answer. It is not derived from first principles. It's just an attempt to build in whatever knowledge we can about what we've already kicked out and combine that with the knowledge we have from the ordinary one-parton-inclusive parton densities that we got. So it's kind of an attempt to do the best we can in the lack of further knowledge.
We should have a wish list.
Yeah.
For experimental measures.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But we have. But we can work on writing that down. So okay. So far, things have been relatively easy for us. So we've gotten a set of interactions, and they've got showers associated with them, starting from beam collinear partons. And we've got a set of partons that are left behind in the beam remnant. We know the flavors of those, but we don't know how they share the remaining momentum in the beam remnant. So what we need to address now is that, okay, these beam collinear partons physically, of course, do not exist. We have, you know, the proton is a confined object, so you have at least some Fermi motion going on inside. And as we were talking about Friday, if you want to get the PT distribution of the set right at the Tevatron, for instance, then you need to put in some primordial KT at the level of maybe even as much as 2 GeV. So how much should you put in? How about the recoils between the beam remnant protons? Obviously, the whole proton has to have a zero KT, right? So how do these things recoil off one another? How do they share the momentum inside the beam remnant? And could you have composite objects like, I mean, if you have two undisturbed valence quarks in the beam remnant, they're probably traveling relatively in the same direction with similar X fractions. So should you think of them as a diquark or as a more free dynamic system? And then the really tough issues, like how are these initiator and beam remnant partons correlated in color? And that's really still a problem. And also how to hadronize systems which contain explicit baryon numbers. So I think I'm just going to skip over this quite quickly. We parameterize just the amount of KT that we, primordial KT that we seem to be needing at different scales. For processes at different scales, and then we just ensure that by various recoil mechanisms that the total KT of the beam is zero. It's not terribly important how we do this, and I think there are some more interesting things that I'd like to get onto. Also, the sharing of the remaining X in the beam remnant, I'm going to go through this rather quickly. We basically just use these remnant PDFs that we have and to assign the X values to the remnant partons to decide how the X is distributed there, with the possible modification that if you have composite systems like diquarks in the beam remnant, then they could have a larger X fraction due to some larger surrounding pion gluon cloud or something. It's an option that you actually find you need to invoke in the old model where you have a diquark beam remnant, that there needs to be an asymmetric X sharing in order to describe data. And we've retained that option here. It's not so interesting. Now we get...
There was something I was looking for. I'm not sure if you said it or not. So as a parton evolves to high Q squared, its radiation leads to partons that are close to it in transverse space. So when you have a hard overlap, the partons that this one is generated in the alteroid Kinesi evolution have a higher probability of seeing the partons that this one is generated. Is that effect really?
No, I mean that could be an option that you could invoke, right? But what we have now is we don't intertwine the showers. So every parton is associated with its own parton shower. Back to the shower cutoff scale. And then you have a completely separate interaction so that we don't intertwine the showers. We don't include that possibility yet. That's one of the things that we're going to be looking at in the future that we haven't done yet. So that's actually the immediate thing that we're going to do next. And arguments such as the one you were proposing there might be interesting to, I mean, we were trying to come up with ideas for how this should be done. And you try to do some kind of backwards Alcibiades-Parisi development where you have two partons that you know and what's the likelihood that they come from a common originator in transverse space and so forth. But it's a tricky issue and we haven't included it yet. But that's on the list of things to do.
That would lead to correlations though.
Right? Sorry?
That would lead to correlations that you would see in the data.
From intertwined showers?
From the two, the certain kinematic regions. Is the idea that you have sort of hot spots inside the proton
I'm trying to understand what we were saying before about clumping distributions of partons. Mm-hmm. So this is a physical mechanism for generating clumping.
Yeah, right. Could be more clumping.
Right. And we certainly didn't see any signs of that with the direct photon data that we showed earlier.
I don't think it's exactly the same question that you're asking. What we're saying, I mean, the parton distributions that we have, they're only saying something about longitudinal space, right? And so one problem is how to distribute the matter inside the proton to calculate an effective overlap, some kind of geometric cross-section for a specific collision. And that you do in transverse space. Now, what...
Sorry, point is important about that way, I guess. Did you sort of show some data to say that the second partons can't just come uniformly across the proton?
Did I show some data to that effect?
No.
Rick, in some sense, you could say that what Rick was showing as the beginning of his plots, when you look at the amount of activity as a function of the BT on the first jets, you see that at the very beginning, you have a very steep rise, and then it kind of levels off and doesn't increase very much.
This feature
of the beginning of the curve, yes, that's right. And that is very crucially dependent on whether you, for instance, assume that all collisions sometimes are equivalent, or whether you assume that you can have both central and peripheral.
Okay.
Because that kind of thing is coming from just going from, so to speak, an unbiased sample, which in fact means much peripheral, to going to central samples. So that feature up there is really very crucial to that kind of behavior. But that's then kind of done in a very, so to speak, uniform fashion. Okay, you have an impact parameter dependence, but then for a given impact parameter, you assume that in some sense all collisions are spread uniformly inside the assumed, so to speak, Gaussian or double Gaussian match distribution. But I think what you were saying was that in fact if you have two scatterings, they could come from having one single parton that branches into two partons perturbatively. And for that reason are very close to each other in transverse momentum space.
But that effect isn't in this model.
And that effect is not in the model, right? So that's what Peter was saying, you're thinking about how to.
I'll include
that. If I could just comment, that would induce correlations in the transverse momentum distributions in double parton scattering. So instead of having PT1 plus PT2 add up to exactly zero, it would add up to a little bit, which would go over to the other area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you would see that. Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so if you go through these steps that we've discussed so far, what you end up with is you've got a series of PT-ordered interactions with showers that do take confinement, or that's better to call it primordial KT effects, into account. And you've got a set of partons left behind in the beam remnant for which you also know at least the momentum and the flavors. So, but as Horace said, life grants nothing to us mortals without hard work, and we're now faced with a very tricky issue, namely, how are these things correlated to each other in color? And that is going to determine how the hadronizing strings form between the final state partons. So for the same momentum configuration, for the same set of partons you've got here, different color correlations will give you radically different multiplicities in the final state, depending on the color correlation. So that's an important question to answer, and it's a very tricky one. Also, you will have to address how systems with explicit baryon number are actually hadronizing. So to start with that simpler question, instead of just taking proton-proton collisions with lots of colors going between the sides, I'm going to imagine a simplified situation and try to ask how we should do this hadronization in that situation where we actually know the colors, and then go on to how the colors might be correlated. So if you just imagine that you place a stick of dynamite inside a proton and you impart all the valence quarks with large momenta relative to each other, how would such a system hadronize?
It's an option.
You know, the stick of dynamite option. So the ordinary Lund string fragmentation model deals with the NC goes to infinity limit, where you have each color line in the final state being matched by exactly one anticolor line or anticolor tag in the final state, and you're hadronizing topologies like this. But, of course, in a baryon, that's an explicit NC equals 3 effect, right? You have three quarks connected antisymmetrically in color. And so if they go out like this, you need to generalize and extend the string fragmentation framework, or any fragmentation framework, to take that into account. So there's no reason to believe that the color lines would still not snap into string-like tubes. And from baryon wave function building, and also just looking at what configuration would minimize the total potential energy contained in strings, we're led to consider the concept of a string junction, where you have three string pieces here coming together at a central junction. And then it's just a question of how to hadronize that. Now, you know the movement of the endpoint quarks, but you don't know how the junction moves to begin with. And that's obviously also important if you're going to do the fragmentation. So the junction is not to be thought of as a parton. It's just a topological feature of the gluon field connecting the three quarks. So it sits there at the center. And when these quarks are going at large momenta, so when the separation between these partons becomes larger than about a Fermi or so, then this string confinement field that has a linear potential should arise between the quarks. And if it comes together at this junction point, then, of course, a linear potential leads to a constant force. So the junction will be stationary in a Lorentz frame where you have exactly 120 degrees between all the string pieces, because then the pull of one string piece will be exactly canceled by the pull of the two other string pieces on that. So there, that point will be stationary, although it doesn't carry energy and momentum of its own. So if you can find the boost to that frame defined by this angular principle from any other frame, the CM frame, the lab frame, or whatever, then obviously the reverse boost will be the motion of the junction in that frame that you come from. And there are some technical details of how we handle kinks on these strings and so forth. I think if you're curious, you should ask afterwards. But the essential thing is that the junction represents the baryon number, right? It's an explicit representation of the baryon number. It's not carried by the valence quarks. It's carried by this topological feature of the gluon field. So the motion of the junction will determine where the beam baryon number ends up in the detector. And the fragmentation around the junction, sorry, I'm pointing to the screen, you can't see that, of course, but the fragmentation around the junction will determine what the flavor composition of the final baryon, final state baryon, carrying the beam baryon number, what that will be. So in this kind of hadronization, you will have a greater degree of decoupling of the baryon number from the valence quarks than in previously existing hadronization models. You can actually decouple it entirely, like you have in this picture. The three valence quarks have nothing to do with the flavors that eventually go to carry the beam baryon number. So how we do it technically is also something I'll probably have to skip. Note that there are other topologies which are possible in proton-antiproton collisions. You have basically a junction and an antijunction, and you can have string pieces spanned between those, and they can even annihilate and give you a different color topology. And if you're curious, again, you should ask questions. So in principle, we think we know how to hadronize these systems once the color flow is known, once the color correlations of the final state particles are known. The question is that we don't know those a priori. Perturbation theory gives us no information. So if you imagine that we now go from placing a stick of dynamite inside the proton to actually having interactions, and we have some parton shower initiators here that participate in interactions somewhere here, and then we have a set of beam remnant partons, then okay, we can say the original valence quarks must be connected sort of anti-symmetrically in color in this way, but we don't know how these things are color correlated to the rest. And that matters, because here is, as I said before, here's an explicit representation of three scattering systems. So you've had three scatterings, which it's an idealized case, so it doesn't represent physics, but it goes to illustrate the point that I want to make, that you have here a rapidity axis, so you have the beam remnant sitting, for instance, at minus a large number down here, and then you have three scattering subsystems, I1, I2, and I3. So this axis is not physical, it's just ordering the interactions in number. But here is a physical scale. And if this is one possible way of arranging these correlations that you saw on the previous transparency. And if you notice, between the beam remnant and the rapidity range here, between the beam remnant and I2, you have two string pieces. So you get two rapidity plateaus there of particle production, which are basically determined by the string fragmentation that you've determined from LEB. And in this region, I2 to I3, you have four string pieces spanned. So you'll get a lot of multiplicity there. And again, between I3 and I1, you have two string pieces. Now, if you connect those things, exactly the same momentum configuration of partons, exactly the same flavor combination of partons, but you give them different initial state color correlations, that could result in a string configuration looking like this, where each of the rapidity ranges is spanned by only two string pieces, and this one as well. So you'll have a smaller multiplicity here than here. And since you've had an equal number of interactions, right, you'll have pumped more perturbative PT into this configuration. Sorry, you'll have pumped equal amounts of perturbative PT into these configurations, both of them. But here, the perturbative PT will be distributed over a smaller number of charged particles. So the average PT per charged particle will be bigger in this configuration. So what kind of ordering mechanisms might there be? Well, the first one is, of course, that you can't have singlet gluons. So if you try to attach these things in ways that would result in one gluon becoming a singlet, then you have to reject that as a non-physical color flow. Unfortunately, that still there's still a large number of possibilities in the average event. So this does not give you a unique answer, just this ordering mechanism. The next, the simplest ordering mechanism that you could think of is just that these things are randomly correlated. Nature doesn't really care how she correlates these initial state partons. But that gives you a very large multiplicity increase per interaction. You'll have string pieces crisscrossing across the event. You'll have multiple string pieces coming to the beam remnant, populating the region there. And you'll get a large degree of baryon number stopping, which empirically may not be desirable. Tune A contains some parameters that basically tell you that you need, for each additional interaction, to add very little multiplicity in order to fit the plots that Rick have been showing. So in Rick's tune, he's really saying that each additional interaction should add very little final state multiplicity. But the parameter controlling that in the old model is basically not a physical parameter. It's just telling you how to hook up the final state colors. It doesn't give you, it doesn't make any statement about the color flow in the event and why this thing happened. So we don't understand why tune A has to be the way it has. We just know that we have to add very little multiplicity for each extra interaction. So you could try smarter ways of connecting these initial state colors now that we want a physical, an understanding of the color flow through the event. You could say it's still random, but you suppress beam remnant breakup, so you don't have multiple string pieces going to the beam remnant, or you try to suppress that. And that'll also give you less baryon number stopping. And you could try different ordering mechanisms. I won't explain what they are. I'll just say that they're not working pretty well. They're not working that well. So this is, again, this average PT of encharged that Rick was also showing. And as you saw, tune A more or less describes the data. And the new models here are lying way too low, which means that we're not optimizing we're getting too long strings per interaction. They need to be reduced further. The color correlations are smarter, or nature arranges it better than what we're capable of thinking out at the present moment. And that's why we're thinking about things like correlated showers and maybe final state interactions. I should note that I'm showing you this plot because it's the most interesting one. It's the only one we can't get right with the new model. So it's not like the whole thing doesn't work. But this is really very sensitive to the color correlations and very interesting to study, because it really looks like you can do a lot of things and get it wrong. So if you get it right, then you're really doing something right, and then you've learned something. So that's our hope.
That's encharged as the horizontal axis?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's really the tail, right, that you're not getting right.
Out here?
Right.
Well, okay, what do you define as the tail? I don't know.
The tail is longer than the dog there, but it's over. No, but I guess what I'm saying is just trying to agree with you that, you know, that's very high multiplicity, right? So that's not very many events that you're getting it far wrong.
No. But still, you've got this very wide multiplicity distribution. I can show you that if you like. I mean, well, you probably know it.
You get the wide multiplicity distribution right?
We can get that fairly right. I can show it to you. We can get that fine. I mean, we've then
but
just to.
Sorry. I should just also say that kind of. I think the point why you're interested in the tail out there is that's in our framework, the events that really contain many multiple interactions. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of why, in some sense, those events are there. They are few in number, but they are the ones where you have to, in principle, the biggest handle on multiple interactions.
Mm. So they're the ones that are most sensitive to your model.
So what's happening right now is that because we have long string lengths in the new scenario, that we're not totally optimizing the way the final state colors are correlated, we don't need that many interactions to get out to this PT tail. So we need to impose a larger PT0 cutoff. So we need to introduce a shorter destructive color interference length than in 2A. And that means that we're not pumping in so much perturbative PT when we go out to these multiplicity RIC, because he always selects the minimal string length in the, more or less, in the final state. He needs to pump in a lot more interactions to, in order to get out there than we do.
So those curves have to agree before you graduate, or?
Well, I could show you a lot of plots that we can get right. So, but this is the most interesting one.
Just say this is not a blessed plot.
it's in the publication.
It's cursed.
Yes. It's cursed. It's cursed. Okay, so this is this PT0, which, so this basically describes what wavelength a gluon has to have before it starts coupling less to the color charges in the proton. And that's not a number that you know from any basic principles.
But I mean that you put some hands together in cross section, which
should
not be.
Sorry?
Mentioned at the beginning of your talk to go to process. I suppose some then you put in also some, not yet.
Yeah.
But this can be in cross sections which do have something to cover.
Yeah, okay, so this is the one Peter is speaking about there, but this is minimum bias. So you have no experimental.
Yeah, there are no jets
or anything. Requirements.
Sure, I know there is no experimental requirement, but you have a model, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you have a theoretical cross-section, which as you shown is increasing very few.
Yeah,
that's
that cut. That's that cut. I mean, but we don't put a.
In the 2GV, the 3GV.
Yeah. So basically that tells you, I mean, if you use a step function, which is not what we're doing, we're doing something more smooth. But ideally, if you use a step function, how you should interpret that is to say that a gluon that is slightly harder than that will couple with full strength to the color charges in the proton. A gluon that has a slightly larger wavelength will see a color singlet proton. So what we do is we smoothly match that, but this PT0 sets the scale for that when that happens. So that's what that parameter means. Okay, so we've played around with a primitive model of color reconnections in the final state, trying to fix up the string length, just to see whether by fixing up the color connections, whether we would eventually be able to, if we had a model that could predict these color correlations, whether we could describe it, and we can get all the way up here. So, I mean, so obviously we need to think about these colors.
I showed you those plots of the same thing, but in the transverse region of a hard scattering.
Yeah, we haven't looked at that.
And it might be different. I mean, it's
sure. I mean, this is just to see that you know, you can play with this distribution by playing with the colors.
Other places where 50 and 2A has a difficult time on describing the bias.
See, that's exactly where we would be very interested, because we'd like to get that right with
sure
the new model, of course.
One of these days, a plot I skipped over.
Yeah, okay.
Those plots that I was showing you on the min bias, where you pick a maximum and then you look at the correlations.
Mm-hmm.
50 and just for min bias events, 50 mm-hmm. and 2A has too strong a correlation there for those. I'll show it to you.
Aha, okay. Sounds interesting.
Even though it describes this thing fairly well, it doesn't describe. Because you see, I think it's harder to get a min bias model than it is to get a model of the hard scattering. So you should first, before you throw this away, I know you want to do both min bias and hard scattering and fit it all together. That's great, but.
Well, it's all the same thing.
To you, it is.
Yeah.
Whether it is in nature. Or
right, but yeah.
And so you should first see how this looks in the transverse region of a hard scattering process. And if, for example, what happens if you agree with that and then agree with this? I mean, you disagree with both of them and then you're consistent with yourself, but.
We're consistently inconsistent.
Yes.
Yeah. See, that, okay. That would be interesting to look at. So some more realistic models, we get spectra like these with some amount of final state reconnections going on. So it's not to say that's a physical model, but at least it inspires us to go on in trying to understand these color flows. So what we're thinking about is these sort of intertwined showers. And so we're going to try to do as much as we possibly can by playing around with the colors in the initial state and to see if we can describe data with only sort of trying to fiddle with the showers in the initial state or with the ordering mechanisms of the initial state colors to see whether that can describe the data. If that just turns out to be impossible, then we may be forced to try to consider something like final state reconnections. But we're going to try to see how far we can get with just considering the colors in the initial state. So things that are basically lacking in our physics description now and try to fix those, like, for instance, these intertwined showers. And then we might go on to add physics components, like the possibility of soft gluon exchanges in the final state and so forth. But we'd like to try to see how far we can get with just playing around with the initial state first. So to summarize, of course, everybody now knows that multiple interactions are real and they exist. But there are many uncertainties in this game, this cutoff here that we were talking about. What the transverse density structure of the proton looks like, what the energy dependence of these mechanisms is, and what these parton densities, I mean, we've tried to do the best job we could, but as you realized, it's still just a crude model that tries to do the best that we can, but they're not the final word. Color correlations and the color reconnection business is really the crucial issue now, and that entails these interferences between showers, perhaps. And these things are really important to understand for hadronic collisions because your final state ends up, your underlying event, your minimum bias collisions end up looking different depending on what you do. And of course, you can imagine extensions to various things, but those things are something somewhere in the future. We're concentrating on proton-proton and trying to understand that. So a new, more physical model, at least, for the underlying event, multiple interactions, also min bias events, is now developed and available in Pythia 6.3. And we're concentrating on trying to figure out how to hook up these colors with each other. But as you can see, that's a non-trivial task to do that. And Rick will really need your help to try to figure that game out. So thanks for your attention.
Make another wish list and schedule another meeting. There's no cookies left, but there's coffee out there.
Oh.
Maybe at this point, if people want to go and get coffee, but also we can ask questions for Rick and Peter for anybody who wants to come.
They're just like Rick, I have a lot of stuff that I haven't showed you, so if you have any questions, or read the article, of course.
So actually, you're really not working with in the context of the factorization theorem for your PDFs, right?
That depends on what you mean by factorization exactly. We're talking multiparton correlated parton distributions. Now, what you mean by factorization in that context, I mean, do you mean that the multiparton density should be a product of single densities? I mean, there are correlations in there. There has to be, right? You know, if you take out a U valence quark, there are not, you know, the object that you leave behind doesn't look the same. Well, at least to us it wouldn't.
Hardcore theoretical basis for it, it might be easier to understand which direction to go.
Well, it'd be interesting to get interaction on that, but I mean, like you were saying, this work by was it Paver and Trilliani?
Right.
So people have been trying to look at, for instance, double parton distributions. The problem is that it's hard to constrain those. But yeah, but still, I mean, if you want to know the flavor distribution of those, I mean, then you're really you're asking very detailed questions.
And here, right, they eventually had some understanding of the Pomeroy, right? That the Pomeroy had its own sort of PDF, and there was some.
I think George is in here.
Theoretical basis for that, right? I'm wondering if they're.
Well, we'd be interesting to interact with anyone who thinks that they could come up with ideas in this realm. I mean, anything that we could use to improve the model.
Yeah. Get some data Kirchner, who does evolution of multi-parton distribution functions.
Right.
It's barely cited, but it looked interesting enough for me to read it, and it seems that this could help you for the intertwining of the showers. In fact, this is something we were thinking about.
Right.
So, I mean, maybe it would be useful to look into this together and check it and do something on it.
What's the name, Kirchner?
Kirchner. It's an old East German from Leipzig. Dates back to 77, 78. I think it was his PhD thesis.
I think we have one of his articles cited, but I don't know if it's the one you're thinking of.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
So now, I mean, we're aware of that. So that's one of the ideas we all. But I mean, so it's certainly going to be useful starting point, but it's not the final answer.
No, it's not the final answer, but what is nice about it is that he has some evolution equation written down, so we have some framework
I mean, another thing that we were just sort of thinking about is that. If you look at a collision and you have two scattering centers that you're evolving backwards, say, and you've gone down to some PT scale, which is this big, let's say that, and you've got some area within which the interactions are overlapping, then, you know, something that happens at very small, let's say you've got some overlap looking like this. So at very high Q squares, I mean, it's very unlikely that these two things will come from a common branching. But as you evolve backwards, the wave functions get larger, right? The wave functions of whatever you're evolving, and that you might want to weight it with some kind of how big the wave function is, 1 over Q squared, 1 over PT squared, of these things you're evolving backwards. So that the very hard, so that if you have two showers that, you know, look like this, then it would become increasingly likely for them to merge, so that you would not, I mean, at this very hard scale, it would be very unlikely because they're probing such small length scales.
But you know what is bad about this Kirchner thing or whatever you try to do is that this will make your parton densities higher at larger scales. Because the splitting term that is in comes with a positive sign. So I just want to say from a technical point of view, it will be quite complicated to just do some reweighting because before that you have to overweight the omission.
Actually, just as a matter of nomenclature, so that's what you mean by the intertangled.
Intertwined? Shower?
Right. Shower.
Yeah.
If you trace back, they're coming from the same splitting.
Yeah, so what we do now is we evolve them all back down to the cutoff scale, right? And we try to hook up the colors down there. And that's a question that's hard to answer, as you saw. Now, another way of doing it would be to try to hook them up at an earlier point before you have so much radiation, right? Get rid of some of the soft radiation.
Yeah.